RN, your world unfolding.
Hi, Paul Barclay here. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. Thanks for your company. Have you ever wondered why time can feel excruciatingly slow when seconds feel like hours, yet on other occasions it's gone in a flash? In a moment, Claudia Hammond looks at the clock and asks, is it possible to retrain our brains and change our relationship with time? Then later on, why calculators should not be used to teach maths. John Adam, author and professor of mathematics, shows how guesstimation can be used to solve quirky problems, like how many piano tuners are in New York City. But first, I'll take you to the RSA in London. In an illuminating address, BBC broadcaster, writer and psychology lecturer Claudia Hammond draws on the latest research in neuroscience, biology and psychology and delves into the misty world of time. How do memories, emotion, health and attention influence our perception of time? Claudia Hammond.
There was an American psychologist called Hudson Hoagland who was working in the 1930s, and he noticed one day that his wife, who had flu, who he was caring for, she complained that every time he went down to the kitchen to get her some water and so on, she would say, he'd been away for ages and ages. Why won't you come back to me faster? Next time, rush back. And he insisted he really hadn't been taking ages at all. And like any good psychologist, he thought something strange was going on here, and this was an opportunity to do an experiment. So he got his poor, very patient wife to repeatedly estimate a minute passing, and he would time her and see how long it took. And he would do this and then take her temperature. He ended up doing this more than 30 times at different temperatures, getting her to estimate again when a minute had passed without counting. And he found that the higher her temperature was, the more time slowed down for her. And this is something that's been confirmed in research since, that having a high temperature is one thing that seems to slow down the perception of time. So a big question is why it is that it does this, why it is that it warps in this strange way. Another strange situation that does it, this is a rather mean experiment that was done in America a few years ago. They got a load of people, about half the number of people in this room now. They got them to mingle together, mingle and just talk about various things like their favourite music and things like that at the start of the experiment. And they all had name badges on. And then they had to write down the names of a couple of people they'd most like to work with in the group, because they told them they were going to be in pairs. So they got together all their bits of paper. And afterwards, they called them in one at a time. And then with half of the people, but one at a time, the experimenter would look really, really embarrassed and say, you know, I'm really embarrassed. This has never, ever happened before, but I'm afraid nobody put you down as someone they'd like to work with. I told you it was a mean experiment, you see. Nobody's put you down. Nobody wants to work with you. So the safest thing is if you work on your own. That'll be fairest. You just go to this room. We'll bring you the tests and you work on your own. And they did this individually with half the people. So they've got all these people feeling sad. Then they tell the other half of the people, oh, a really strange thing has happened, but this has never happened before. Everybody has put you down. It would be very unfair for us to choose who you should work with. So the only fair thing is if you work on your own, if you'd like to come with us to this room here. So they end up with all these people, half of them sad in their room, wondering why does everyone hates them, and half very pleased with themselves because they've realised actually they're really, really popular and that's nice. And the first test they give them is a test of time perception. So again, they have to estimate time passing. And they found that for the rejected group, once again, time slowed down. So they've started to focus in on themselves, and time really slows down. Whereas the popular group, time went faster for them. They were having a good time, they weren't focusing on themselves, and time seemed to go faster. So rejection is another of the things that can do that. So the big question is why it is that time can warp in this way. And it's all to do with the way we assess time passing. And the reason is that we actively construct our experience of time, the experience that we all sort of know what time feels like, we actively construct that in our minds. And we can sense time passing. We know we're very good at estimating a minute passing, in fact. We're quite good at estimating 2 hours passing, and we can hold in mind the years and the centuries passing as well. And what's amazing is that no single dedicated clock in the mind has been found that can do this. So there is, obviously, there's the body clock, which controls our sleep-wake cycle in our makes our cycle be 24 hours and is corrected by light every 24 hours. But this is completely different from that. So nobody can find a single dedicated clock. And there's various thoughts about how we can do it. And it seems that we can do this whole range of things. We can go from the tiniest millisecond timing. So if you put your hand on your voice box and you say pa and ba, you do exactly the same thing with your mouth if you do pa and ba. The only difference is that with the pa, there's a very slightly longer delay between the P and the A than there is between the B and the A. And you can feel it's a millisecond longer. But we're able to detect that, and that gives us enables us to understand language. So these milliseconds really matter. And yet at the other end, we can hold the idea of hours and days and weeks and years in mind. So there's various theories about why this might be. One of them is called the oddball effect. This is very well established within psychology. And you can have a go at it here. And the oddball effect gives you various objects. You have to say which single one of these you thought flashed on the screen for longest. So who thinks one of the giraffes was there for longest? Anyone, doesn't matter. Who thinks giraffes were there for longest? A couple of people there, a few people there. Who thinks the mango was there for longest? More people there. Who thinks they were there for the same amount of time? Clever bunch you get at the RSA, that's the trouble with here. Yes, they were there for the same amount of time, but if you do this repeatedly with lots of people will think, far more people will think that the mango was there for longer. So this is known as the oddball effect, and when there's something new, we focus on it and we notice that. This has been used to try to work out what it is that allows us to measure time passing. And so one factor is our attention on things, is where we focus our attention. So you've already seen the giraffe several times, so you don't need to focus your attention on it so much. The mango comes up again. It also shows how memory is involved, and memory is another of the big factors. So the giraffe is already there in your memory, the mango isn't, and it's a new picture. You've got to think about recognizing that. And there's various theories, and that makes time slow down slightly because you're noticing it. So there's various theories about how we actually do this. Some people think there might be a whole series of clocks for different durations, that to measure the milliseconds that we do that perhaps in a very different way, and different parts of the brain do seem to be implicated in measuring milliseconds from longer time frames. Even time frames of 3 seconds or more seem to be done in a very different way from milliseconds. So one theory is that there's a whole series of perhaps sort of hourglasses. Another theory is that there's this whole series of different clocks. The idea I like is that the brain is actually, because we can't find where these clocks are, that the brain is actually measuring the activity that's going on for something else, which could be anything, which could be facial recognition, it could be anything, that it's taking the pulses that are already there and counting them up. And so if you imagine there must be some sort of way of these pulses coming and the brain counting them, or some sort of counter to count them up. So if you imagine sheep going through a gate, then the more sheep that go through, if, say, you're in a terrifying experience, the more sheep go through because you're paying more attention to it and your emotions are very high, and we know emotion slows down time, more sheep go through the gate, so the counter then thinks that more time has passed because those pulses get speeded up, if you like. The brain's actual processes get speeded up. And emotion is this third big factor that affects our time perception. So there's attention and memory, and emotion is the big one. And when people are scared, people do have this feeling very much that time slows down. And another theory is that we're actually counting time by registering almost emotional moments. The sort of, how am I feeling now? How am I feeling now? How am I feeling now? And we're registering all those. And the more emotional those moments are, the more individual ones will get registered. And then we think again that time has slowed down. Also, of course, when you're very afraid, fear narrows your attention. You focus on everything you can to try and save yourself in that car accident, and you stop noticing the other cues to time passing. So you don't notice, say, other cars that are passing, or that the music has changed on the radio. And boredom does the opposite, because with boredom, we start focusing on time itself, and that makes things very difficult. And what is, I think, extraordinary about time is that it's not just the seconds that we can hear, that we can understand, and the minutes. We can deal with much, much longer time frames than that. So we can think back years, decades. We can think back to the time before we were born. We have a concept. We're able to hold a concept in mind of centuries. And I'm interested in how it is we conceptualize these in our minds. And it turns out that 1 in 5 people will actually visualize time laid out before them in their minds. And this is considered to be a type of synesthesia called time-space synesthesia. So it may be that you see the year laid out in an oval, or it may be that you see things stretched out before you. And I actually got Radio 4 listeners to get in touch to tell me how they could see time for a program I was doing and whether they did. And loads of people sent me, people even sent me drawings of how they saw time. And people had amazing descriptions. One woman who was a comedian said she saw time like a slinky. And she could see the weeks all laid out in her slinky, and she could actually book gigs by when she was free at different points on the slinky. She could see it pictured there very, very strongly. It was very common for people to also see sometimes colours for their days of the week as well. If you don't see time, this may seem completely strange. I mean, particularly one man said that he saw the year in the shape of Zimbabwe, which seemed very specific. But if you don't see time in mind, this could sound like total nonsense. But in fact, these are very constant, and you can test people over time, over years and years, and these things will stay the same. And so they're not just making it up. And you can do various tests on the computer to see whether they can respond fast to things on one side of the screen or other, depending on how they see their year laid out. And that's very easy to test and replicate. But to an extent, we all associate time with space. We all see time in space. If I were to give you flashcards that said on them past, present, and future, most of you would put the past on the left and the present in the middle and the future on the right if I got you to lay it out. Most people for whom English is a first language will do it that way and will read it in the same way they might read across a page. The past is there and the end of the book is there and the future on the right. Lyra Boroditsky, who's done a lot of work on this, has done this with various people from different places, and Mandarin speakers will do it up vertically instead and will say the past is up there, and people will refer to it in conversation as the past being up there and the future being down there. Now, and obviously Mandarin is written vertically. Modern version of Mandarin is starting to be written across the page. It'll be interesting to see whether that changes people's conception of how that works. Now, just in your own minds, when you think this was, so the explosion at Chernobyl nuclear power plant, April 1986, Michael Jackson died, that was June 2009, 3 years ago, Hurricane Katrina strikes New Orleans, that was 2005. So people will often be surprised that things seem to happen more recently than they think. And this has been quite well established, and there's lots of research on this, and it's referred to as telescoping. And the idea is that if we remember something well, we assume it happened recently, because we use clarity of memory as a guide to when something happened. But this is sometimes given as the explanation for why time speeds up as you get older. But in fact, if you give these tests of dates to people, it's the middle-aged people who really think that things happen more recently than they did. Once people are much older than that, they tend to do it more accurately again and can even think that things happened longer ago than they did. So telescoping isn't, I don't think, an explanation for why we think time speeds up as we get older. Another thing people will often say is, oh, I know why time speeds up. It's because it's all about proportionality. And that a year when you're 8 is an eighth of your life, a year when you're 40 is a 40th of your life. Again, that's more of a description of what happens, that people, it is very, very common to say life seems to be speeding up. It's more of a description than an explanation for what actually happens. Because if that were to hold, then by the time you're 40, one day would feel like 1/14,000th of your life, which means it should absolutely whiz by, because that's nothing at all. It also means that if you were to live till 80, by the time you're 20, you would have lived half of your subjective life, which would be a depressing thought. But so it doesn't quite hold the proportionality theory. It is a description, but it's not how people actually experience life. People don't necessarily say that the days go really fast as they get older. Obviously they do if you're busy, but it's the weeks and the years and the time. It's that you notice it's almost summer again, it's almost Christmas again, and that these things seem to repeat faster and faster and come round more and more. So I think it's due to what I call the holiday paradox. So this was what I mentioned, where when you're on holiday, it seems to go fast at the time, but you look back and it seems to have gone slowly. Even if you just go away for a couple of days at a weekend, if you go away on the Sunday night, it feels like you haven't been at work for a while. If you stay at home, it seems it's Friday night, and in no time, it's Monday morning and it's time to go to work again. If you apply this idea of the holiday paradox to how we look at time in our whole lives, the thing is that we look at time all the time prospectively, so what's going on now, and retrospectively. So if we're asking retrospectively, we're saying, how is it when I look back at it? Prospectively, how's it looking on now? All the time, we look at time through this dual perspective. And when you're on holiday, you think it's going fast at this moment. You look back and it seems to be going slowly. The same happens with life. So with life on a longer basis, the days seem to be going at a normal speed, but it's the years that seem to be going fast and the weeks. It's when you look back that things seem to be going fast. And part of the reason is as well, you notice these markers in time, and the markers in time, particularly if people have children, then the children do keep growing, which is a really obvious marker in time that that time is passing. Or, shockingly, you'll see things we own in vintage shops, which has to be wrong, obviously, that time could possibly have gone that fast, but it does. And so these markers in time make it very, very distinctive. And the remedy, if you want life to slow down, and there is a question about whether you want life to slow down, because, in fact, lots of the situations where life goes really slowly are not that desirable. So, you know, being very afraid, feeling rejected, being bored, if people feel depressed, time seems to slow down. If people are feeling suicidal, time really, really slows down. So you could argue that if time seems to be going fast, that's a sign of a busy, interesting life, and that perhaps you shouldn't be trying to worry too much about that going fast, because the alternative, you know, might be worse. But if you really do want time to go faster, to not go so fast, then you need to recreate the holiday paradox. So if you want the weekend to seem as if it's going slowly, then what you need to do is to fill it with new things, because you're filling it with new memories then. So you go and do one thing on Saturday morning and something else on Saturday afternoon, and then you are filling it with all these new memories. And since we use memories as a guide to how much time has passed, then you'll think that the weekend has gone more slowly. Now, obviously, when you look back at it retrospectively, now, obviously, that does involve sacrificing rest, I'm afraid, for doing lots of stuff. So you may just decide not to worry so much about time going so fast and to rest instead, which I have to admit is sort of what I do. And that maybe it not to worry about it so much. It's also very interesting how you can use these things to try and change your perception of time. Now, I notice that the clock is starting to beat me, and there's lots more interesting things I could talk about. I'm very interested in mental time travel, how it is that we can step back in our minds into the past just like that, and then forwards into the future, and why it is that I think the reason our memories are so unreliable and often let us down is actually to allow us to think forward into the future. It's to allow us to get those memories and make them very flexible so that we can imagine the future, and we can imagine the future in ways that no other animals can. So there's lots more to say about how you can use the research to speed time up or to slow it down. I only talk about anything that's based on evidence, because I'm obsessed with everything being evidence-based. So very quickly, in my last 30 seconds, I have with me my antique countdown clock here, which I got on eBay, which people are very jealous about, because it does make the noise and do the light. So I'm just going to use my last 30 seconds just to mention a couple of interesting things. There's the French potholer who tested his own time perception by isolating himself underground in a cave with only a spider for a friend. There's the reverend who wrote probably the longest diary in the world, noting how he spent every minute of every day. And the man whose disorder of time perception made him think the working day had finished by lunchtime. Then there's loads of experiments throwing people off buildings backwards or persuading them to steer themselves off a precipice, all in the name of experimentation. Now, that might have felt like a long talk or a short one. It all depends on your perception of time. Thank you.
Claudia Hammond with some of the ways we perceive, measure and respond to the passing of time on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. You're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. You can tweet or follow us at RN Big Ideas. Let's head back now to London for some questions from the floor. To start off the conversation, moderator Matthew Taylor, the RSA Chief Executive.
So I've got two questions before we open it up. The first is, there's a wonderful interview with Dennis Potter towards the very end of his life. And also, I've been reading the wonderful book that Philip Gould wrote at the very end of his life. And they both describe something amazing and kind of transcendent that happens when you know you've got very little time to live. And a kind of sense of seeing things in a way that they'd never seen things before, because they don't have anything else attached to them other than the thing that they are. They have no other meaning for them, because there is no meaning for them going forward. I'm interested in your kind of sense of what's going on when that happens.
Well, what is really interesting is when some research has been done on the time perception of people when they're dying and when they know they're dying. And interestingly, time people often report that time just slowed down in that circumstance. Whereas you think it might speed up, and that if someone might know that they have 6 months or a year to live, you think it would just seem like it went just like that. But people seem to report often that time actually slows down. Or they report like this, that they've almost stepped outside time, because it's taken away that whole idea of there being a future to imagine. And we spend, if you look at brain scanning studies, the default position of the brain often seems to be thinking about the future. So when we think we're doing nothing, if you get people to think about nothing, in fact, they think about the future. And people have tried to estimate that we think about the future 59 times a day on average. How on earth they quite work that out, I don't know. But that we think about it 59 times a day. And of course, if you're dying, that future is taken away. And so that default mode of keep thinking about the future isn't going to happen. And then people can find themselves living more in the moment in a way that the rest of us often try to live in the moment. And so, you know, people will have had that experience that you're even on holiday somewhere really lovely, you think, oh, I must really enjoy this moment, this is really, really beautiful, and within seconds you're looking in the book to see where it is you can go tomorrow, and what thinking about what you might eat tonight and what you might do. And it's very hard to enjoy that actual moment and be in that moment. But often people, when they're dying, will step out of that and find that they can.
Now, one of the kind of recurrent themes in stuff that interests us is the point that I think Daniel Dennett best made, which is that we're trying to cope with the modern world using a prehistorically evolved brain. I'm interested in your sense, therefore, of the degree to which our cognitive frailties around time are to do with the fact that we, for 190,000 years, time, the meaning of time was very different. For example, there wasn't really much of a long term, because life just went on and on and on, and there was not much point planning for the long term if you were a hunter-gatherer. So what's your kind of sense of the relationship here between our perception of time and our kind of evolution?
Well, it's interesting that we are very bad at predicting the future, and predicting particularly how we'll feel in the future. So there's a thing called the impact bias that a psychologist called Daniel Gilbert's done a lot of work on, and so have a lot of other people. And the impact bias is that we overestimate how we will feel about things in the future emotionally. So we think that the good things will make us happier for longer. So something like getting the promotion you've really been wanting at work, extra happiness from that seems to last on average about 3 months and then wear off. And people predict that it will make them happier for much, much longer. They think it will change everything. Likewise, people predict that very sad, terrible events will affect them forever, whereas in fact their happiness levels might be like this, and the good things will make it go up slightly and the bad things will make it go down very slightly, but they'll often come back to it. And the problem with the impact bias is that we... And this could be because we haven't evolved enough to really consider the future very well and to make very good predictions about it. And what we do with the impact bias is that we focus on the chief features of an event and the earliest features of it. So you get that job you've really been wanting, and you imagine what you might do on your first day and in your first weeks there. And you also just think of the main thing of this new job. What you might not take into account is that you're leaving the place where you actually really like everyone you work with, and that perhaps you've got a longer commute now, and these fringe bits of it you don't consider so much in your thoughts about how you'll do it. And the other thing, of course, we're very bad at about the future is planning how long things will take if we're doing them ourselves. And so this is known as the planning fallacy, is the idea that you can do things in less time than you think. I certainly thought that when I was writing a book about time. But I did think when I gave it in late, it's quite good to have an excuse that's evidence-based, you know. But many of us have this belief that in the future we will have more time, and there's no evidence that you'll have more time free in the future unless you're going to change something, and that we'll be better, more organised versions of ourselves in the future, and so we'll be more organised about it. And so if someone said to me, oh, you know, can you come to Liverpool next week and give a talk? I know that next week I'm far too busy, I've got loads of things to do, I can't possibly go to Liverpool. If someone says, can you come to Liverpool next February and give a talk, then I'll probably say yes, thinking, oh, that'll be fine, I'll make time by then, that'll be fine. Whereas in fact, when it gets to that week, I'll be thinking, I can't possibly fit in going to Liverpool, what am I thinking? Why did I agree to that? So in a sense, we're very bad at guessing how long things will take. You can do it better by imagining they're going to be the next week, or by getting someone else to do it, because we're very good at guessing how long other people's things will take. So although we're optimistically think we can get our kitchen all done in a week and it'll all be done and lovely. Other people will tell us straight away, oh, it'll take longer than that. So, and they did one study where they got students to guess when other people would finish their PhDs, and they guessed when other people would finish them, but not when they would their own themselves. But they took into account all the things that might happen for the friends, which, like, you know, they'll be ill for a while or someone will turn up unexpectedly, all those things will happen. And they took those into account, whereas they didn't for themselves.
That kind of issue, which I think behavioural economists talk about in terms of our discount rate, is of course an issue for policymakers. Mm. So the big time question for policymakers is, how do we get people to do today what they say that they want to do in the long term? And that's the justification, for example, for the fact that the new pension system next year will be an auto-enrolment system where you have to opt out rather than opting in, based upon what nudge theorists call changing our choice architecture. So what do you think, are there other implications of understanding our idiosyncratic approach to time for policymakers?
I think there are. I mean, I think one of the things that governments should take notice of is that because we take notice of the initial features and then actually it wears off how much we mind about things. And so, in fact, whenever a government is new, they should do all the boldest things first, because we will forget by the time the next election comes around, and people do get used to bold things. It depends whether you get used to it. So something like the ban on smoking in public places was unpopular with some smokers. The surveys that have been done since show that it's less unpopular with those smokers now. You know, the actual reality of it, they've got used to it. So in a way, people they should do their really bold things at the beginning, particularly if they're good things, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, so opening up now to questions from you.
Hello, thank you, Claudia. That was really interesting. Have you done any work on sort of mindfulness and meditation techniques and their relation to time?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, actually, the research that's been done on mindfulness. And mindfulness is increasingly getting a good, you know, evidence base now, and research from, you know, Mark Williams' research in Oxford shows how effective it can be for people with depression. And so there has been work on what's interesting with mindfulness is that it is a way of making time go faster when you want it to. So, in fact, you could see your 20 minutes having to wait for your train as the perfect 20 minutes to practice mindfulness and to get really good at that and to focus on all the little details of all the senses of what's going on around you and to become very, very aware of that. Some people will say that during meditation or mindful meditation that they feel they're outside time. So time's not exactly going slowly or fast, that they feel that they're outside it, that it's giving them a new experience of that, which is the same thing that will happen when people experience what psychologists call flow, this when you're completely absorbed in something, which might be painting or gardening or whatever it is that absorbs you, you won't notice the time actually passing, and the time, you don't know what time it is, and mindfulness can do the same thing. But definitely helps people to live more in the present, if people want to live in the present.
Claudia, have you done any work with, particularly the elderly, with mental conditions such as memory loss? And I'm thinking of my mother-in-law, who has a very unusual sense of time now. She's in her 80s, doesn't quite know which day of the week or whether something was yesterday or 25 years ago. Is that something you've looked into?
Yes, it is. I mean, it is. So there's lots of research on how common it is for people to get very confused about time. And then interesting things happen with memory that often the earlier memories will start to get clearer as people get older and people will start talking a lot about their childhoods. But their spacing of time and events, they will often think things happened longer ago than they did. So it's the opposite of the middle age, people thinking things happened more recently, that they'll start thinking that they happened a really long time ago, but that those memories will get clearer as well. And of course, people can find it very disorientating. Not to know what day of the week it is isn't a nice feeling, and, you know, it can be very disorientating. And that's why some places will deliberately try to design places very well so that clocks are very prominent and will say what the day is so that people can sort of constitute themselves back within a time frame, because it does seem to be something we really like. And one of the things that Alan Johnston said to me that he found most difficult was not knowing the time. You know, didn't have a watch. He had heard them wedding calls and he would work out the times by that, but actually hated not knowing the time, which would be similar in a sense.
I'm horrified to learn that the higher my temperature, the slower my time perception. I mean, this is ghastly, isn't it? What could be the evolutionary advantage of that?
I mean, it's interesting to say, is there an advantage? So it has to be a proper high temperature, like having a fever. So just being outside in the nice sun today isn't going to make the day go really slowly. But Nobody knows whether there's an evolutionary advantage to it, but nobody knows exactly why it happens. I mean, one of the theories is that if the brain is measuring its own pulses, or if it's somehow measuring processes going on in the body, that when you have a higher temperature, your heart rate goes up, and could that then be affecting your perception of time then? But nobody has managed to prove an exact link between those things. So it's something of a mystery there.
I don't know what the evolutionary advantage is of thinking everything's got an evolutionary cause. That's my big question. Yep.
You mentioned something, and it occurred to me, if you watch a kettle boil, it takes an infuriating amount of time, and hence the expression, a watched kettle never boils.
Which appears in the book, I can tell you.
Oh, does it?
It does.
Whose book?
This book.
I shall get it.
But do you want to talk about the watch kettle never boils phenomenon?
Yes. And in fact, there is. When I was thinking of titles for the books, I thought, shall I call it A Watched Pot? And then found there was already a book called A Watched Pot, so I'm not called it that. But yes, so basically, if you watch something like that, then you start focusing on time itself, in a sense. And that's when it then seems to, and focusing on time itself changes your attention, and your attention is one of the things that slows down time. So it seems to go really slowly when you're doing that. And the same happens when you're bored, you know, because it is boring, obviously, watching the kettle. But you start to focus on time itself. So it's when you're either focusing on time itself or internally to you that things go.
When you said about time slows down for people facing death and so on, I mean, that would seem natural to me because you would attach greater significance to the day or period of time you have left. So,
yeah.
And the same then with childhood, the milestones, everything's a milestone in childhood, and in middle age it isn't, and so on. So isn't it just that we attach significance to that quantity of time?
And it could be, for example, that the reason that much older people don't have this problem about thinking things happen further back than they actually happen is because when you get old, you just kind of realise there's so much stuff that's happened. It no longer has that emotional effect on you.
Yeah, no, I mean, that could be the case. And that also, so routines do have a lot to do with it. So when you're, they find that more people remember things from between the ages of 15 and 25, known as the reminiscence bump, and people have much stronger memories of that time. So if you ask people what they're, to name some favourite songs and favourite films and a time when they felt really happy and a time when they felt really sad, they will often give those memories as something that happened within that reminiscence bump, 15 to 25. And that's absolutely a time of firsts of all kinds and of new experiences. And obviously, as you get older, there is more routine and fewer new experiences. And so it's very easy to remember exactly where you were when you lived in certain places when you're sort of 21, 22, because you're living in one place here and then one place in the next year. And you can work out exactly when things happened. As you get older and things get more routine and you live in the same place for longer, then it's harder to then put those events into specific time zones and to know exactly when they happened, because inevitably there are more routines and routines cause the problems. And obviously with small children, people have to have routines because it's good for them. But it makes it very difficult to differentiate the days from each other. So often parents of really small children will say that the days go slowly, repeating the same things, but the weeks go really fast because there aren't loads and loads of new memories again. So it's about this quantity of memories that you build up.
Hi. Do you think new technology and modes of communication has affected our perception of time?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of Zimbardo-esque stuff about...
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, they've done work on people... people playing computer games massively underestimate the time that they think has passed while they've been playing. And so people will play for 2 hours and swear that it's an hour. And many people will have had... Certainly, I've nearly let the bath overrun many times when I just thought, oh, I'll just go online quickly and just check my emails. And that the time really does seem to, you know, change there. So there has been work on people underestimating how much time they do with new technology. And what would be interesting to look at, I think, is how it might change people's time perception of the fact that they're always sort of on call on the time, even if they're talking to their friends, but how that might change people's perception of the different times of day and evening and so on over time. I don't know yet.
I'm really curious about this. Is it really true that when you're dreaming, it seems like hours, but it's only a few seconds?
Yeah, so dreams are really quick, yeah. Mm. So you can have loads and loads of dreams that you don't remember and they seem really quick. But what's interesting about being asleep is that you do have a sense of time passing when you're asleep that you don't have when people are under general anaesthetic. So you do the counting, you know, counting backwards from 10 and you're out, and then people have a six-hour operation and think they woke up, and just like that, they have no sense of the time passing. Which may be to do with one of the theories is that we are counting the alpha waves as what we're counting to assess time passing in the brain, and that you don't experience alpha waves when you're under general anaesthetic. But also with dreams, some people can do a thing where they wake up and they know the time as well and can guess it very accurately. And in 1917, this couple who were wonderfully named Mr. and Mrs. Boring decided to do an experiment on this where they woke people up at random, and somehow they got people to agree to do this, and they woke them up at random and tried to get them to guess what time it was, and they found that some people could do it absolutely exactly, and they never worked out why, and nobody knows why.
Like everyone else present, I've found this lecture enthralling, but if I tell friends I've been here and they say to me, what's the importance of the subject of perception of time, what reply can I give them?
Yeah, you see, I think it's fascinating because it's something that we never get used to time warping in the way that it does. And so we constantly, people will remark on, you know, their holiday seeming to have gone very quickly, or it feels like they were away for ages. And constantly, when it sort of goes wrong, we never quite get used to that. So I think it's really interesting to work out why it is that this happens and how it is the mind does it. But also that you can then start to change your perception of time if you want to. So you can deliberately do things that make time go slow, more slowly. You can deliberately do things that make time speed up, and you can become more accurate about how you predict what you will do in the future, what you will think about things in the future, by taking things from all the research that's been done. And this is, you know, research from all around the world, and I think there's loads that you can take and do yourself.
Claudia Hammond, BBC broadcaster, author and psychology lecturer. Her latest book, Time Warped: Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception, is published by Canongate. On RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. How can guesstimation be used to solve life's quirky problems? To find out, we'll stay at the RSA in London and join mathematician John Adam for an overview of his book, X and the City: Modelling Aspects of Urban Life. John Adam is Professor of Mathematics at Old Dominion University in Virginia.
The book I didn't want to write. You see, in the spirit of shameless self-promotion, here we've got, this was my first book, Mathematics in Nature. Mathematical modelling is a constant theme of the things that I'm interested in. But more recently, a mathematical nature walk. And my editor and others said, why don't you write a mathematical city walk? And I'm not a city boy. I'm a country boy, and I really resisted the idea, particularly walking around, because with this book, I could have chapters relating to different parts of life when you're out in the country, or when you're at the beach, or when you're out on a night in the evening and looking at stars and things. So there were natural things I could associate with it. Not so much in the city. I mean, you could walk around and talk about buildings and angles and depths and so on. But it wasn't until I realized that I could really broaden this out to include traffic flow and congestion and models of road networks and pollution and so on, and even optics in the city, because things at night are very different, obviously, from during the day. But in particular, a lot of the optical phenomena they talk about in this book, rainbows and ice crystal halos and things called glories, which are those lovely coloured rings that you may see around the shadow of a plane when you're high above the cloud bank. But anyway, a lot of that is to do with the fact that the sun is so far away that the light from it is effectively parallel, the light rays. Whereas in the city, of course, you've got nearby light sources, and so the light is divergent, and some of these phenomena have very different, they appear in different guises, let's say. So I then decided, yes, I got quite excited about mathematical modelling. So the topics I'm going to cover briefly today, just going to give you a flavour of some of the things in the book, hopefully a nice flavour, but there really isn't time to go into anything in any depth, and anyway, I don't understand what I wrote, and not knowing something about a subject's never stopped me talking about it before. But I want to introduce you to Fermi problems. Now this, again, relates to a topic of an earlier book, but I use some of it in X and the City. I'll explain what this is. A little bit of using guesstimation to get some ideas about number of dental offices or eating places in a city. A little bit about travel speeds and times. We'll tell you when doomsday is, power laws of city growth, and then something called taxi cab geometry. So these are just little staccato images, if you were, as it were, of what's in the book, and there's much more. So Enrico Fermi, a very famous theoretical physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project, he had this amazing capacity for doing problems on the back of an envelope, or indeed in his head, that took mathematicians maybe weeks and weeks and weeks with their calculating machines, and he would get the rough order of magnitude, and that was often all he needed, a ballpark figure. By order of magnitude, I mean to within a power of 10, so factors of 2 or 3 are not important with these kind of problems. You want to be within the nearest power of 10. It doesn't work if you're doing taxes, of course, so you have to apply different techniques. The classic Fermi problem is how many piano tuners are there in New York City? Well, what a silly question. Who on earth wants to know that? But the point is that by breaking a seemingly complex problem down into smaller sub-problems and with some plausible assumptions and basic arithmetic, you can get a ballpark figure. And the point I try to get across to students is that, okay, some of these questions are very silly, but some are very practical. And it's the techniques that's important. You don't need to sort of shake your head and say, oh, we can't possibly do that. Well, we can if we make reasonable assumptions. Now, in what follows, were you to do the problem, you'd probably make slightly different assumptions from me, but I suspect that at the end of the calculation, we'd both be within a factor of 10 of the answer, and which we hope is within a factor of 10 of the correct answer. So some of the questions, we're not going to address them here today, it's the total length of the average woman's hair, how many people in the world are picking their noses at this moment. I will tell you that middle school and high school students like that kind of question. How long would it take to empty Loch Ness with a one-gallon container and thus expose the monster? Other questions, what's the total volume of human blood in the world? It would cover Central Park, basically, in New York, to a depth of about 50 feet. How much would the ocean surface rise if the ice caps melted? This is all in guesstimation. How many cells are there in the human body? We've mentioned this. How long is her hair? About 50 kilometers. How large was the asteroid that caused the demise of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago? What's the typical surface area of a bathroom, or surface area of a typical bathroom towel? People immediately, automatically go for, well, it's just length times breadth times 2. It's got a front and a back. But all the little fibers, it can add up, several hundred square feet for the really fluffy towels. How many porta-potties would you need for a gathering of 1 million people? This actually made the New York Times prior to the inauguration of President Obama, because they were expecting about 1 million people. It turns out you need about 1 in 100 and then scale it up a little bit. So 1 per 100 and then maybe 2 or 3 per 100 just to be on the safe side. So let's go back to this New York City problem. And I'm actually going to apply this shortly to X in the City. Okay, how many people are in New York City? Well, more than 1 million, I know that, and fewer than 100 million. I will use the Goldilocks principle, square root of the product, geometric mean, to guess 10 million. Again, the metropolitan New York area has probably got double that. But how many families are there in a city of 10 million people? Well, you can have family units, domestic systems units of 1 up to, 10 probably. But I took 5, just some kind of average, because I can divide by 5 relatively easy. More easily, that gives me 2 million units, families. Does every family own a piano? No. Let's use the geometric, the Goldilocks principle. More than 1% and fewer than 100. So we'll take the geometric mean, 10%. So we'll divide that 2 million by 10 to get 200,000. Again, this figure 2 is suspect. And it's more important to get the exponent right in the power of 10. So how many piano tuners are needed? Well, some people never get round to tuning their piano. Some tune it regularly. I assumed, and you would vary, you might vary this, but on average, piano gets tuned about once a year. So that's about 200,000 a year, give or take. What about piano tuners? How many can they do in a day? Well, I assumed sort of 2, allowing for travel time, office time, and so on. 50 weeks, 5 working days, 250 working days a year, which means that our piano tuner, let's call him Fred, can do about 500 a year, so we divide that into the 200,000, and get 400. Now, again, what it means really is this is probably more than 100 and fewer than 1,000. Okay, somewhere in that ballpark. Okay, so one of the questions posed in the book, and there's a variety of things in the book. It goes from the sublime to the ridiculous, applied arithmetic to some fairly interesting, I think, differential equations. But anybody with some calculus background or some algebra background should have no problem with most of it. So, similar idea, how many eating places are there in a city of 1 million people? Well, now, you know, in the States, it's probably different from here, but, you know, eating out, or at least used to be, a regular occurrence. It's getting harder because, you know, with the economy and everything. But I took typically 100 times a year, whether it's going to McDonald's or whether it's eating at a restaurant. A year of 400 days in this case, serving maybe 50 people an hour. Again, this will depend on your own experience. And open for 10 hours a day, just to illustrate the point, we get 10 to the 8 over 200,000, and that's about 500. So again, the 5 is suspect, but it's probably between 100 and 1,000. Okay, now we move on to a different typeset too. Move on to a problem about travel. I've got sections on driving in the city, and indeed one is not driving in the city, and I've got various small chapters about different aspects of the transportation system. I should point out, I am a jack of all trades and master of none, so I will try to answer any questions you may have, but don't expect sensible answers. But anyway, so here's just a nice silly problem which you might be able to earn a beer over in a pub. A car travels from home in the suburbs, maintains a constant speed of 30 miles an hour. On the return journey, it maintains a constant speed of 60 miles an hour. What's its average speed? Now, there's a gut response to that, which would be 45, which isn't right, of course, but that's the meaning. Oh, yes, of course, okay. of course, you can justify it by saying, well, they're going uphill on the way there. But what we're going to be dealing with is something called the harmonic mean. It doesn't matter what it's called, but we haven't specified the distance. Let's just call it D. Now, the average speed is the total distance covered over the total time, right? So the total distance is 2D or not 2D. That is the question. Shakespeare had a handle on this. And we divide by the total travel time, T. Well, the travel time is the sum of the individual journeys. So distance over 30 miles an hour plus distance over 60 miles an hour. The D's cancel, and you end up with 40 miles an hour, which, of course, makes sense because you spend longer going up at 30 miles an hour than you do at 60 miles an hour. So it's weighted towards the lower value. And this is called the harmonic mean. And if you really want to impress somebody once you've earned your pint, point out that it's the reciprocal of the arithmetic mean of the reciprocals. So, thank you for not picking your noses, and thank you for not dividing by zero. We are done.
Well, thanks, John. We look at policy here at the RSA. We develop policy recommendations. Is it your sense that the policymakers often want a kind of bogus certainty? They want to be given a specific figure, a particular prediction, to give them security, and it would be better for them to be told,
yes,
we can only give you a guesstimate.
Yes, yeah, certainly. And I would think that's even more important, even more relevant to politics. Just give me an answer that I can use to bend to my own ends. And people are uncomfortable with a level of uncertainty. And so I think very bad decisions may have been made in the past and will continue to be made because people opted for something certain, which was meaningless, as opposed to a range that would have been much more helpful. So, yes, it is a concern.
There's a big crisis about maths in Britain.
And in the US.
And the US. What do you think is the thing that we're getting wrong about engaging young people in maths?
Oh, where to start? How long have we got?
I cannot give me your top two
speak
things.
to the current system here, because I've been out of it for so long. But in the US, the biggest single problem, in my view, is calculators. Students use calculators almost from the ground up, from the womb up. They are taught basically to rely on them as a crutch. They do not think, they don't estimate. I have no idea whether this is in the right order of magnitude. And so when they come now in our university, when we teach calculus 1, 2, 3, and 4 in particular, we do not use the use, we do not allow the use of calculators in any algebra, trigonometry, or calculus. We have students coming in who have such poor backgrounds in those subjects that they have to take it almost remedially. But they may have done very well at high school in calculus, but get placed into a lower level because they don't know how to manipulate logarithms and exponentials. They've done it by pressing buttons. So they don't have the concept in mind, and so we have to retrain them. So to me, the use of calculators is one of the biggest problems. We certainly need them if we've got, at the end of the calculation, we've got all these numbers and we want to do the sum. We still need to know if, you know, if it looks right. But there are now calculators coming out which won't give you the answer until you guesstimate it first.
Oh, really?
And then you can turn that facility off, but then a little red light flashes, so the teacher knows that they've turned it off. So I would say that's the biggest overall thing. The second thing, briefly, is that we have a lot of teachers who end up by osmosis or diffusion teaching mathematics when in fact they're not comfortable with mathematics. Mrs. Jones broke her leg, so can you teach geometry for this semester? And if Mr. Smith is very uncomfortable with that, then that's often transferred to the students, the problem perpetuates itself because we've all probably had teachers who marked us down for the right answer because we did it a different way. And if they're not comfortable with it, then if you didn't do it their way, it was wrong, kind of thing. So that's scary too. So we need better trained teachers.
And what about the wonder of the subject? You know, we've had a number of speakers here over the last couple of years who are so excited by maths, and yet my experience is that most kids are not excited by maths at all.
Yeah, well, I think a good teacher can help.
Do you think
that regard.
Do you think when it comes to maths, we should start off by telling people some of the amazing stuff they'll get to at the end? I mean, sometimes I think the problem with maths is that we teach people this rather dull stuff, and the idea is you've got to do the dull stuff, and then eventually you get to some clever stuff. But maybe if we started by saying to 6-year-olds, it is said that if everyone in China jumped off a chair at the same time, a tidal wave would engulf America.
Yes, or if...
But how would you answer that, by the way?
I would say that we would do the anti-jumping off. So everybody in America would jump off out of phase because they'd have to jump from higher up because there's fewer people. So they would have to cancel it out, okay? And they'd all end up dead
I wasn't asking as a policy problem. I was asking anyway. It's fine. But you agree, we need to start with the amazing stuff.
Yes.
The stuff that kids want to go home and tell their parents about.
Yes, yes. I mean, show them some snapshots from the top of the mountain. And then as they grow into that, just show them how you get there. I've had people say, I wish I'd had you as a math teacher when I was younger. And I've said, I wish I had me as a math teacher because I was always bad at algebra. Can I just share this story about my teacher? Have we got time for that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to be an astronomer because at 14 years of age, I read a book by Sir Patrick Moore, The Observer's Book of Astronomy. And I voraciously read everything I could on astronomy. So when I was at Henley Grammar School, the algebra teacher was going around the room and saying, what did we want to be when we grew up? Oh, sir, I want to be an astronomer, sir. He was a very nervous little man. You're bottom of the class in algebra. I suggest you think of another career. Even observational astronomers need to know a lot of mathematics. So I just plodded. I decided, right, I'm going to do this. Plod. But to me, now, looking back, you know, I plodded and I still plod, but when I've grasped something, it's mine, and I love to share it. So I think if we can get students to the point where they can see for themselves why this is so fascinating, what's going on here, and that we can get there in a series of steps. They don't need to know all the details till later, but yes, we need to excite them rather than saying, no, you've got to start here before you can get right to the top.
John Adam, Professor of Mathematics at Old Dominion University, Virginia. His book, X and the City, Modelling Aspects of Urban Life, is published by Princeton University Press. If you'd like to watch a video of John Adam's RSA lecture or our earlier speaker, Claudia Hammond, on her book, Time Warped, both are available in full and online, courtesy of the RSA. We'll post a link here at bigideas.abc.net/radionational. That's it for tonight. Tomorrow night, what's wrong with our political leaders? And why do we so frequently suspect them of being less than honest with us? John Cain and Haig Papatan discuss the fragile legitimacy of democratic leadership. I'm Paul Barclay. Look forward to your company again tomorrow night for the best of Big Ideas on RN Summer. Happy New Year.